Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audible.com/Dan Carlin and get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership.
It's Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
So let me start today's program off with just a quick update, because I'll solve a lot of problems right off the bat if I do that. I am working on the next history show, and we are at that stage where my brain has turned to jelly, maybe jam at this point. So I apologize for any mental inconsistencies, or maybe for more mental inconsistencies than normal. I kind of cheated with today's program, but I mean, I think you'll be glad I did when you hear how I cheated. If you read the description of the show, you probably know how I cheated already. But we're going to have James Burke back on the program. If you're a James Burke fan, I mean, I'll pull up a chair. You already know how this is going to be. If you're young enough to not have been exposed to his work yet, go online. You'll find stuff from Connections or The Day the Universe Changed on some website somewhere. I'm not encouraging piracy, you understand, but I'm sure you know what you're doing. Nonetheless, he's awesome, and he's one of those people that, and I'm just one of millions of people who fall into this category. He could stimulate you mentally. You would watch his programs, and he would say things where you would just be a series of light bulbs going on over your head. If you're happy to have one good idea in a week, watching a James Burke show could give you 10 or 12 in an episode where the light bulbs just kept going, and so you haven't recovered from the last light bulb and the next one goes on. Profound thinking, stimulation of areas of the brain that once he turns on, I'm not sure they ever turned off again. When those light bulbs went on in a different corner of your brain, they stayed lit. I'm not sure there's any more of a profound thing a human being can do than to do that to millions of other human beings in terms of how that affects the greater good in the long run. Anyway, happy, happy, happy to get the chance to expose a few more of you to the guy and at the same time, you know, sort of cover up my jellied brain at the moment. For those of you who keep asking for hints, I will say this. For the first time in a long time, it's a Blitz edition, which once upon a time used to mean my attempt at trying to do a shorter show. And we know how ridiculous that turned out to be in terms of attempts. And it turned into a different kind of focus of a show. So unlike the normal history episodes that are more about an event or a place or a time and you give the narrative history of it, the Blitz editions are things that more explore concepts or ideas or questions, using history as sort of a backdrop and a tool to emphasize things and to take a look at things and ask questions. So it's kind of a different focus. If you haven't heard one of those before, well, you know, we do have them on the website. They're probably in the archive section right now. But if it's been a while and you liked those, well, you're going to get one again soon. And if you didn't like them, then I pretty much turned my brain into a bowl full of jelly for no good reason. And I'm sorry. After the Burke discussion, I try to catch up on a couple of things, including the Trump appointees as we know them right now. I don't think that's the most scintillating of content. So if you're not into politics at that level, you know, I would call it a show there. If you're one of those hardcore that wants to hear all that kind of analysis, well, I sit down and we'll talk about it and grab a cup of coffee. And if you didn't like it at the end, we're going to blame it all on the hardcore history jelly problem. So without further ado, why don't we start the conversation with somebody who, after I spoke to him, I felt a little better mentally. It's like one of those drinks from the Lord of the Rings that the elves gives you. And no matter how tired you are, it perks you up a little bit. I got a little James Burke in me and was temporarily better. So without further ado, the wonderful James Burke. So first of all, the last time we spoke, you were working on the Knowledge Web. I know there's a lot of people that would love to know what you're up to now, and I know you're eager to discuss it. So explain, if you can, what's going on and how people can get involved.
Well, the situation with the Knowledge Web is that it's still, you know, advancing work in progress. At the moment, it consists of, it's like a giant spider's web. It involves about 2,700 people from history, each one of which is linked by marriage or work or influence or whatever reasons they're linked to between 10 and maybe 30 people. So these 2,700 people are linked about 30,000 ways. And the name of the game with the web is to take journeys through that web from one person to another to discover unusual and exciting and odd ways in which people are connected and why change comes about the way it does when people get together. You can get to the Knowledge Web by going to its website, which is k-web.org, and go from there and play with it and see what you think. Each node has its own biography, and so each time you land somewhere, you can see what you want to see about the person involved and choose where you want to go from there. The app, which is not out yet but is about to be launched, is called the James Burke Connections app. It's really being run by a guy called Rich Ingram at James Madison University. He and his team have developed it. And that's a kind of trick for enabling people to take, as it were, my approach, which is being called these days connectivist, and to approach the Wikipedia with a device that allows you to go into Wikipedia and say, where do I want to start? Who do I want to choose to start? And where do I want to go? Or if I don't know where I want to go, show me some interesting stuff. Or if I want to link, see if there's a link between A and Q, do that journey for me. Or I can do an end product like take me to Mozart from me and see how you are linked to Mozart, and so on. That thing is being kicked off with crowdfunding through Kickstarter, and I think what they're planning to do is to go out there and ask everybody to pay up, as everyone does these days, $5 or $10 or $100, whatever you want to do. And then the interesting thing about that is that if you're interested in the connectivist view and the knowledge web approach, then taking that approach to Wikipedia is kind of mind-boggling, because where my little web has 2,700 people linked 30,000 ways, Wikipedia has something like 5 million people, as yet not linked in the way my K-web does. So it's a very, very, very big deal, exciting thing to try and do. And to do that, you just get on to Kickstarter, or you use the web site, which is James Burke Connections app, and go from there.
We'll make sure to link to that on our website, too, so that people can find it easily through the notes.
Thank you.
No problem. So the last time we spoke, we got into some subjects that I have been thinking about ever since. And I just, of course, I have to pick up all my James Burke books and go through them before you and I have a discussion go ahead.
Poor man.
Yeah, I don't think so. And as a matter of fact, that's kind of where I was going to go with this. I remember the first time I ever saw a computer chip. I think it was on the end of your finger. And mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, that's middle 1980s, early to middle 1980s. How do you think we're doing on that whole computer chip future front? And how different are things developing from the way you envisioned them way back when you were first introducing us to the entire concept?
Well, in the late 70s and early 80s, when I started doing that kind of stuff, I don't think any of us realized the extent to which computing would develop in terms of speed and scale. I know that the Moore's Law, says you get, I forget what it is, twice as much every year or something. The speed with which computing has developed has left everybody behind in that sense. And with the advent of nanotechnology, which is, working at the atomic level, you're beginning to think astronomically large speed and storage capability and computing capability being enabled within a device as small as a number of atoms. So the whole matter of computing is, I think, presenting us with some major social problems, because I think the vast majority of people don't understand what's going on in the world of computing. The people in the world of computing are brilliant at what they do, but not necessarily good at translating it into ordinary English. And the trouble is, it is absolutely essential that we, the general public, understand as much as we can about what's going on in computing, because of what computing does to our daily lives. Everything from automating the job that we used to do and now don't do because a computer does it, to accelerating the speed of change so that stuff changes faster than we can handle it socially. I mean, these days, by the time you can understand the manual, the gizmo is obsolete. Not just because we like to know how machines work, but because of what the machines do to us. The ripple effects of developments in this field are again, astronomically large. And, I mean, this has happened all through history, but never at this scale before. And, I mean, I could go on for hours about why that matters in terms of whether or not our institutions, all the way from commerce to education to government, understand what's happening and can keep up with what's happening and are capable of handling what's happening, and if not, what we should do about it.
I'm reminded of the Manhattan Project, and where you have these physicists who are so ahead of the game in terms of science that they can make this amazing new superweapon, but then they have to hand the superweapon off to people who aren't quite physicists, who then have to decide how to employ it. I have a book here that's edited by the physicist from, I think it was Oxford, Nick Bostrom, who talks about the potential for catastrophic change. You know, he'll talk about, can a meteor wipe out the planet, or volcanism, or all these kinds of things, and yet it's astounding how many of the possible ways we could destroy ourselves are based on things like the out-of-growth artificial intelligence worst-case scenarios and whatnot. Back in the early 80s when you showed me that computer chip, I had this overall feeling of an optimistic future, that this will help us solve so many problems. Is it normal for humankind, as you see it, when we're a little bit deeper into the experiment, to become a little bit more scared by the potential and seeing more of the potential downsides than 30 or 40 years ago, when it all looked like a way to solve our problems? The kitchen of the future today.
Several things obtained there. It's very important to understand the downside, because only by understanding the downside do you avoid the downside. And the other thing about whether or not that makes us more optimistic, the key thing to be said is that, you know, pessimists jump out of the window and are no longer involved. You know, the only way you can solve the problem is by sticking with it and trying to solve it. The scale, I keep returning to, the scale is the issue. Once upon a time, you know, we had to try and get our heads around something pretty simple. What will the printing press do to us? Well, it'll do more than print Bibles, which is why it was invented in the first place. You know, I mean, we could go on all day about what the printing press did for us. But at the time, it was a pretty simple decision. The computer and what it does is immensely more complex and affects every aspect of society, to the extent that I don't believe any single group of individuals, any single institution, can get a general enough handle on it. You see, you know, it's all very well for you to say, well, this institution can handle this aspect of computers and what they'll do to us. But then when you act, you in turn create ripples that affect other areas of society. And often, indeed, I would argue almost always, people don't understand that these ripples exist at all, or indeed how they will affect society. You know, the guy who produced the typewriter could never have realized that one of the things it would do in bringing women out of the kitchen into the office would be to boost the divorce rate, which is what it did. So there are social effects that you kind of, by definition, can't foresee. But what you can do, I suppose, I would hope, is try to develop a kind of monitoring system that keeps an eye on what's out there and what is likely to be coming down the pike. And that's where, you know, stuff like my little knowledge web, I hope, trains people to think in that connectivist way, to look for what I believe statisticians call the outriders. That is to say, the anomalies, the unexpected, apparently unimportant anomalies in the scenario, where if you take a good look, you'll see that's where the change is really going to happen. And I think a sort of connectivist approach to thinking can train people to see that way, to look that way at what's going on, instead of what we've had up until now, which is laudable and started by good old René Descartes, specialist thinking, that has created, you know, zillion scientific disciplines, each of which has acolytes working in their ivory towers, producing wonderful stuff and making us the healthiest, wealthiest people in history. But at the same time, it is virtually incomprehensible if you try to understand it the way the people in the ivory tower do, which you'll never do because you don't have 5 PhDs in that subject. But there are indications of what's coming out of that tower if you look, as it were, at the ripples instead of the source. I don't know whether that makes any sense or not.
It does, but it's getting me thinking. You know, I'm at the age where I'm parenting teenagers right now, and it's amazing to have to contend with, you know, and I think most parents in the last 100 years have probably had the same problem. You have to teach your kids how to navigate a world that's foreign to you. And so my kids will walk around asking Siri on their iPhone all these questions that you used to have to do by hand. And I've come to wonder if there won't be, you know, you think about this a generation or two down the road. I had done a show on the Greeks and Persian wars a while back, and we were talking about what the Persians could do, putting together these massive armies of men and not a computer amongst them. And could we do that today if we had to return to that? When I was in the newsroom as a reporter, I was there when they made the change from pen and pencil and typewriter to computers, and we didn't know how we were going to do it. And in 6 months, we couldn't have gone back to the way we used to do it. My kids, if you turned off things like Siri tomorrow, I don't know where they would be. What do you make of an evolutionary trend, if you project it forwards, of people relying so much on the technology like that that they could hardly do a decent math problem without the help?
Well, I mean, you know, you could have said that about, again, the printing press. The plain fact is Siri is not going to be turned off. The technology is not going to fail because there are too many fail-safes. The distribution of the technology is so wide that it's almost impossible for any. There is no central source where it can go wrong and everything fail. So I don't think it's realistic to think in terms of the kids not being able to use Siri anymore. Whether or not being reliant on Siri is a good or a bad thing could have been said about the printing press. And the reason you ask that question is because you're old and they're young.
That's exactly right. Okay, so I had said, besides the obvious things I'd like to see you do in the future, I think a James Burke satellite navigation app seems a logical thing. You could tell me how San Francisco is connected to Los Angeles in terms of highways. I would love to see, though, and I think everyone in the United States these days would love to see something that would allow them a James Burke wisdom filter, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
So think of like Siri, but instead of Siri, it's you talking back to me, interpreting something I just saw and helping me understand it in a better context. Are you just bored with things like politics and what's going on in the world in your day-to-day newspapers, or do you follow it? And if you follow it, you know, obviously we're in one of those hyperdrive periods where things are moving pretty quickly. What do you make of what's going on in Europe and the United States these days in an overall current events sense?
I think we're in what might be described as a perfect storm. I think a couple of things obtain. On the one hand, the speed with which change is happening and the ripple effect that it causes socially are putting our institutions under unprecedented stress, because most of our institutions began in the past to solve problems of the past using the technology of the past according to the values of the past. I mean, I'm thinking of things like government and banking and marriage and religion and, you know, the fundamental institutions of any society. These are being shaken to close to failure, I believe, by the advent, above all, of the internet and the apparent availability of information on an unprecedented scale and total access, which, of course, doesn't mean a thing. You know, if anybody says, here's all the Greek you could ever know, and you don't know Greek, it's useless to you. So on the one hand, we have institutions that are really, particularly in politics, are 18th and 19th century institutions trying to handle 21st century problems and failing seriously. I mean, the second thing is that the internet has given us the feeling that we can know anything very quickly by simply accessing the internet. What it also does, of course, in presenting us the world in that way, is to make many of us realize that we really don't have much of a say in what goes on in life, that our representatives act in some cases as if we didn't exist, that perhaps it's not frequent enough to ask us to vote about things once every 4 years or 3 years or 2 years, and that perhaps two political parties, let's be wild and say three or four political parties, with their different ideologies, will be enough to represent all 300 million of us, which is self-evidently idiotic. And what the internet has done is to give a large number of people the feeling that they are no longer having their say, in spite of the fact that the internet says they have their say, because the institutions appear to ignore what it is they say. Now, I think what's happened in America right just now, and Brexit here, and maybe Italy, but I'm not sure, is that I think some of those people are starting to say, hey, in a democracy, the voice of the people is the voice of God, vox populi, vox Dei. And in this case, guys, you are ignoring us, so we're having our say. This then comes back to the problem of how fast change is occurring and how well our educational processes are keeping up with informing us about how to handle that change and indeed educating us at all in the new world that you were talking about your kids earlier, the new world where Siri exists. Many people over 15 years of age are already feeling left behind by this very fast-changing world, but on the other hand, have a voice to say something about it, and I believe that's what happened in America and in Britain in the last year. Whether or not this is a good, bad, or indifferent thing, I don't want to make a judgment, but it does seem to me that we live in what will be increasingly turbulent times until we resolve this issue of transitioning through to the point where we use our technology to replace the 18th century and 19th century institutions with which we have functioned until now, and which are increasingly, I think, incompetent.
What do you think happens in terms of, in a long-term sense, what the internet has done to government transparency? And I mean, when I was growing up, my earliest memories are of them wheeling an old television into our third or fourth grade classroom to show us the Watergate hearings so that we could find out some of the secret stuff that was going on in government. And then you have, you know, things like Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, and these all seem such singular things back then. Now it's hard to keep up with the Edward Snowdens or the revelations that come out, or the hacking, or the charges of other governments interfering through cyberspace with clouding what the reality of truth might be. I mean, you and I last talked, and we talked about governments, and you had said, and I'll misquote you here badly, but something about, you know, I think what we think we see has never been what we see, and we decided it was all Bismarck behind the scenes. If we can't keep the Bismarckian agreements secret, they don't really function anymore. How much of a change is it going to be if government finds out they're going to have to operate more in the open because the internet is not, you know, it's too Swiss cheesy to ever keep closed? I mean, how much will that, I mean, it's almost like if the Bolsheviks release the agreements about the secret treaties in the First World War while the First World War is going on or before it even starts, does that put the kibosh on all of the ideas? In other words, can government, as we've come to understand it, function with these kind of Daniel Ellsberg leaks happening on a regular basis?
Well, there are a number of things, as always, to say about that. Number one, I think a government would not continue to function if it had to be transparent, because a great deal of what goes on has to be behind closed doors, because, as you said, if people were to really know what's going on, they would not understand the complexities of the issue and therefore might argue with what was being discussed or what was being arranged. The number of back-channel activities going on between apparent ideological enemies, I mean, especially I was thinking during the Cold War, would have been regarded with horror if we had simply told people they were going on. I don't believe that the presence of the internet at the moment means that the government will be forced into more transparency. It will be forced into more apparent transparency. And the problem with that is it fits neatly with the way in which the internet has, let me be rude here, Disneyfied life. I mean, the presence of the internet, the presence of the screen, the presence of what really echoes Hollywood means that what we see every day is more and more a kind of Disneyfication of what the world is about. It's a show. It is presented as a show by everybody from a CEO to a president, because that's the way we have been, taught to think about this new medium. I mean, after all, it's a little bit like the old movies. I mean, it's on a screen, and what we get is movies. And what I look for in the longer term is that this issue becomes irrelevant because government becomes irrelevant, because we stop using an 18th century system that didn't work in the first place anyway, which was why you had invented the Electoral College. I mean, you know, it's not a democracy. Democracy, as Winston Churchill said, was the least bad of all the choices. Democracy is 360 million opinions feeding into a process that allows true majority to have its say and to be affected immediately by the machines available to cause to come about whatever that majority wants, and to do that every second of the day. And algorithms will, within, I think, 20 or 30 years, be able to do that, and therefore effectively to replace this super simple nonsense that we live with at the moment, where you know, two parties tell 360 million people their choice is two.
You know, it gets me to thinking about some of the science fiction I remember as a kid, where you would take maybe the old Athenian idea of democracy, where it's not a representative government, but where you actually get the voting, the ones who can vote anyway, into the room together and say, okay, shall we send a ship expedition to Corcyra? Vote on that now, you know, public, and where you're voting on every single issue as opposed to letting a representative. Yes. Does something like that sound hopeful or scary, if you could ever invent it where we could do that, like through your television set, just vote tomorrow on whether or not we invade Iraq? Or, I mean, is that frightening as all heck, or does that sound better than the current situation?
Well, I mean, let me add one more thing to the mix. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to go to your television and vote. I mean, you can be voted for on behalf of you by semi-intelligent entities that will act as you. I mean, there's a thing, oh, I wish I could remember its name. It was a system developed by a psychiatrist in America in the late 40s, at which you sit somebody down and you say, tell me all the things you like and tell me all the things you don't like. Now let's go through your life and see which people fit into which slots, like, dislike. And you find at some point that you have said, I like dark-haired, tall girls. And here's a girl in your list that suddenly turns out to be somebody you like a great deal, who is small and round and blonde. And the machine says to you, why did you do that? You say, well, wait a minute. I like small, blonde, round girls on Thursdays. So what you do is you resolve the inconsistencies in your own view of the world. Now, today, that is very relatively easy to do. You sit down in front of a computer, and the computer asks you these questions, and it comes to pretty accurate view of your view of the world, and it can represent you in all matters that involve, for example, the government or decisions about society or whatever. And if it comes up against something that it can't, it doesn't fit your gestalt, it can pop back out and say, hey, come over here and tell me. I've found something that doesn't fit with what you say. Make a decision now. But you only get involved at the point where your algorithm finds it cannot solve the situation, knowing what it knows about you, needs to know a bit more. Now, I don't think that's far away. I think, again, that's just 20 or 30 years from now. And what you do is you live your life, and the semi-intelligent entities deal with the necessary activity that has to be done to keep society being what you would like. And theoretically, of course, if you don't like what is happening, at least you know for certain that a majority does.
So it's the Siri democracy.
Either we're democratic or we're not.
And it's the Siri democracy at that point. Okay, so then you bring up another question, and this gets me back to a fundamental James Burke thing I always remember you talking about, and that is the growth in collective intelligence and the fact that, you know, once upon a time, such a tiny amount of the population's brain power was being used because they were the only ones allowed to be educated and involved in the current affairs and the things that were happening. The ideas that you just presented, which I think are fundamental to the democratic ideal, is that people can do this. Are you still sure that they can? I mean, in my darkest moments, and I'm a huge democratic proponent, I worry about that. I worry about the difference between, you know, there was a wonderful animated series called The Simpsons here that's still on, and they had one.
Yeah, sure, yes.
Okay, and they had the one episode where they played with the idea of putting the super intelligent people in charge of, like, the city council. And it's like everybody's dream, right? You finally have the really. But they screwed everything up for totally different reasons, for super intelligent reasons. I mean, is the idea that the. You know, I read a book on ancient Athens democracy not that long ago where they talked about how the ancient Athenians had a whole idea about why a layperson can make complicated decisions that you would think a specialist would be required, but there are ways human beings can decide between specialists. Are you still pretty sure that a system where the average Joes and Janes on the street had their Siri avatar representative voting for them and 300 million opinions are registered, that they would make good choices, or would we be better off with, like, a philosopher king, a Marcus Aurelius?
What did he say? Every time I hear the word good choices, I reach for my revolver. I mean, that's a value-loaded statement, good choices. The question is, it seems to me, a mathematical one. Do we want society to be what most of us want, or don't we? Simple as that. And if most of us want something absolutely horrendous, then is there a way in which we can encourage most of us to go back to school or to learn more things or to change their behavior in any way whatsoever? And again, you feed that into the system. It seems to me, above all, before we can get to this stage and get through this transitional period I was talking about before, we have to take the matter of education extremely seriously. I mean, I said to you last time we talked, the business about, you know, everybody having about 100 billion neurons in their skull, and in an average healthy brain works just the same way as Einstein's did. The reason it doesn't produce brilliant stuff could well be to do with the fact that the educational system is so profoundly simplified that it can only handle, I don't know, 100 models of a brain and call that intelligence. It can't possibly deal with the astronomically high number of idiosyncratic ways in which individual brains work. But semi-intelligent Siri-type software could deal with that. And I think the minute we get to that stage, we're going to start seeing stuff we've never seen before, because that kind of brain has never been given the means to say anything before. I can't say any more than that because it's waffle.
Well, okay, so then let's talk a little bit then about something that I think flows through like a thread of everything we've talked about. The difference between objective truth and something else. I was going back and reading The Day the Universe Changed before this discussion today, and you have this wonderful piece at the end that struck me as very representative of what we see now. You were talking about how the disciplines of geology and biology split when new scientific discoveries put pressure on the church's traditional view of things. So they actually, essentially, if I'm paraphrasing here, put their own person on the scientific board to represent their viewpoint. It reminded me of everything from the dilemma of 45 years ago, or does smoking cause cancer or not, or climate change today. What do you do if we can't even, I mean, the Europeans think we're all crazy in the United States because we have a debate over climate change. What do you do if different people have differing views on what the truth is and then vote accordingly? Or is that, maybe that's a dumb question, because that's always been the case, hasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, the question is, can we make it less so than it was in the past, when five people were literate and everybody else did what they said? I think the matter is, the question is how you decide whether or not there is enough evidence to show that something is, quote, the truth, unquote, or not. And those who question climate change, those who support climate change, we have the means, technically, to resolve this issue one way or the other, but we don't get to resolve it because it's one hell of a good story for the press. And the press, I think, well, let's not get onto that. I mean, the press have, I think, a massive amount of dereliction of duty to answer for, especially in the last 10 years. You know, it doesn't help us at all for the press to choose one side or other in these arguments and then ignore any evidence to the contrary. You know, there is or there isn't climate change, and my personal attitude is it doesn't matter whether or not we are causing it. The fact that there are variations, cyclical variations in the temperature of the planet has to be taken into, I mean, nobody argues that. And if this is one of those, then is there anything we can do to mitigate the effect it might have on us? The problem is, it seems to me, that these major problems of things like climate change and pollution and overpopulation, and so on, these will all be utterly irrelevant within 50 years, and yet we are busting a gut, in some cases, doing serious harm socially and economically to our societies in order to try and solve these problems, when the problems will be gone in 50 years' time, when the nanofabricator arrives and blows them all away.
Can you rely on that?
With it, everything else in the present day economy.
Can human beings plan for that? I mean, could you say something like, I mean, what you just said sounds so profound and so wonderfully simple that you would love to be able to say, let's not worry about this problem because technology will solve it down the road. I remember my stepfather, who died of cancer, saying, you won't have to worry about dying from cancer. Medical science will fix that. I mean, I think I'm genetically inclined to fall into your solution there, because it sounds wonderful. But can you rely on it and plan for that?
Well, look, if the United States decided to run a project with all the intensity and involvement that it ran the Apollo project on bringing the nanofabricator into existence sooner than 50 years, putting money into nanotechnological research, then we would know fairly rapidly whether the nanofabricator is going to happen. And if it does, then we could start to plan socially for what we do when it turns up, because it's going to cause, like all technological advance, massive social ripples. I mean, what do we do when the nanofabricator gives you everything you need using dirt, air, and water, and a minor amount of other things, but which most people can get their hands on for nothing at all, and it gives you everything you need? You want the Mona Lisa, a block of gold, you want food, you want to build a house, you want to live in Antarctica. I mean, the nanofabricator will do all these things for you. And the diaspora out of the cities and out of the nations across a planet, ending up with individuals living in tiny communities because that's what they want to do, with a population density perhaps equal to Indiana today, that is something that hasn't happened in our society since we left the caves. But this time round, we can communicate with each other holographically as if we were in the same room. That is a one-liner describing the most complex society in human history, and it could be coming 50 years from now. And we'd know better about it if we were to put more effort into trying to work out in advance how this kind of machine would work and when we could have it.
Well, that brings me to the idea of the difference between the chaos theory of allocating human intelligence versus a goal-driven one. So you mentioned Apollo. I mentioned the Manhattan Project. I'm fascinated sometimes when you go back and you read some of the fascist theoretical literature from the 30s, where they were talking about an entire society but run by one single mind, right? Purpose-driven as opposed to chaotic like ours is, which is based on what do you want to do for a living? Okay, you have an aptitude for this. Okay, why don't you go to school and see if you can get a job, and eventually maybe you end up in physics and maybe you invent nanotechnology, as opposed to a government saying, to hell with that, we're going to be like the Soviets were with Olympic athletes, we're going to give you steroids, we're going to give you brain medication, and we're going to throw you all into a room and tell you to develop nanotechnology. If it was a you-know-what-hits-the-fan moment, develop nanotechnology or else, could we do a better job of it if society decided we were going to make a conscious, you know, single mind effort versus the way we do things now, which is a very democratic, very freedom oriented way?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not a cataclysmic decision. To make such a decision like the Apollo project, as far as I recall, the Apollo project cost as much money as American women spent on lipstick at the same time. So it's not going to break the bank. It will have to be introduced top down. It will have to be introduced by a government saying let's do this, and we can afford it. But it will concentrate the minds of everybody on the subject. As for preferring top down or chaos bottom up, the fascist model worked then. There's far too many cats out of too many bags now for any of that stuff to happen, I don't think. I think the question of some kind of totalitarian, authoritarian form of government in the West is gone forever. I can't see how. I mean, the algorithm, maybe, but I can't even see that, because by definition, in a sense, if you set up an algorithmic form of government where it's, you know, listening to your avatar every second for all 350 million of you, it's going to be pretty damn hard to hack it on a scale that allows it to become authoritarian in one particular mode.
Can we survive the destabilization period that happens as we get used to this? I mean, I think the West was probably more set up to deal with the destabilizing forces. I think when you look at some of these places in the world that are having a harder time adjusting to, shall we say, being thrown into the pool all at once, maybe the Arab Spring is an example of the beginnings of a destabilization. I mean, can we handle the I used to describe the First World War as the shaking out of a whole, or the modern society is a shaking out of the contradictions and deformities caused by the First World War. Can we handle the shakeout period from all this that we're going through right now?
Well, I think the effects on the Third World are going to be pretty drastic, and whether or not they survive the shakeout, I wonder. We have, I think, enough safety net to survive. But I think, as I said right at the beginning, we're in for a very turbulent few years, if not a few decades ahead. And I think what has happened in your elections and the Brexit decision are the very, very first glimmerings of that.
Okay, now I'm going to put you on the spot before I let you go. I want to know if a new president or a new prime minister somewhere said, we need some better advisors here. I'm a big James Burke fan. I'm going to bring you in. And what I want is, I just want some advice. And you can decide what the advice is and where the advice would be applied and what it would be concerning. You know, if you sit around the house muttering after reading the morning paper about, you know, the stupid people should be doing this, should be, what would you tell this society that's asking for your advice? I mean, you know, you want to bring Plato, Aristotle, let's bring some great minds in here to re-examine, get a new eyeball on this situation. What would you tell them?
I'd say put a massive amount of effort into improving the educational system. Everything springs from giving people the kind of education that allows them to think more clearly and express themselves more clearly. Everything springs from that.
My thanks to James Burke for coming on the program again. One of the perks of this gig is that you get to interview your heroes sometimes. He's been a big influence on a lot of people, me included. So, didn't he sound a little like a neo-prudentist at times to you, Ben, or is that just me? You know, the not sounding so happy with the representation of the political party, systems outdated. I mean, it sounded a little like it, didn't it? Maybe that's where I got it from. Maybe that's just another way James Burke influenced me. If you want to help his Kickstarter project along, go to Kickstarter.com and look up James Burke Connections app. We will put a link on the notes on our website to it as well, and I will tweet out the link at DC Common Sense and at Hardcore History. So, yeah, love everything this guy does. I do want to mention that we closed down our online forum the other day. Sad to see it go. Very long time, more than 10 years. Some of the survivors have moved over to martinhash.com, over to their forum. So if you're looking for them, if you feel like you can't find them, go to martinhash.com and they'll be on his forums there. And I'm glad they found a place to land. So thanks for a lot of good years and great conversations, though, guys. I was looking at the file today before I came in here, and I thought, you know, after we talked to Mr. Burke, we should at least update on some other things. I didn't want to make it an hour and 45-minute show or anything like that, but I took out this topic file, you know, that I keep, and I cut this story out, and I say, oh, this will be interesting, and I print that one out, and they end up in the file, and then when it's showtime, I open up the file, and I start doing triage. Is this more interesting than that? When was the last time we discussed this subject? You know, that kind of thing. And as I opened this morning, I realized how many stories just got buried by the election. And not just the election, but it's a presidential election, which is always huge. This one involved Trump and the whole, I mean, it was an enormous election, and it buried everything, including the entire pipeline protest that happened in the Dakotas, which we should have done something on. That's something I feel bad about now. We should have done something on that. And who knew it was going to be over? But apparently, and I would call this, let's call it a temporary victory, and suggest that anybody should be giddy that they got that these days. But the Army Corps of Engineers sort of, you know, are pulling back. Some financiers to the pipeline are going to pull out if the indigenous rights and the rights of the Native Americans aren't protected and all this kind of stuff. You'll pardon me if I'm not specifically that interested in the pipeline or the environmental impact or any of that at all. The part that I'm interested in is the right to protest. And it was many years ago now that I remember, and we've talked about it on the program a few times, 60 Minutes, the TV news magazine, had done a show, I want to say early 1990s, just guessing off the top of my head, though, where they were showing all of the sort of space age tools that were being developed to someday allow authorities to quell protests more easily. And the story, again, going from memory here, but I remember being really impacted by it, and we've talked about it since. The story indicated essentially that harming protesters was counterproductive. And Gandhi, by the way, was, you know, the one who talked about the need to sort of take a blow on the head, maybe, as a way to show, to sort of shame the other side, right? Or at least put them in a negative light. And so this 60 Minutes episode showed the things that were being developed so that you could get the effect of quelling the protest without giving the protesters any ammunition to use in the realm of public opinion. So one of the things I remember, because it exists now, was the sonic cannon, the thing that could be targeted and would go into these places and could make sound to a degree where it was painful and you would just leave the area. Now, you may say, well, listen, Dan, that's a huge improvement over clubbing them over the head. Yes, at the same time, though, if you were to be able to make it easy to break up protests, is that necessarily a good thing? I mean, we had talked about Martin Luther King and his famous lunch counter protest and how there was something very effective in the iconic photos of him being arrested for sitting at an all-white lunch counter. And we had talked a while back about, you know, what if you could have just gone up to him and stuck him with something that made him comply with no muss, no fuss, and he's gone. Now, he went out there and still protested, but at the same time, the sense of injustice that came with seeing a proud, upstanding reverend handcuffed for daring to sit at an all-white counter, you lose some of the impact. When you talk about what really catches the attention of a lot of people in that protest that happened in the Dakotas happened as a result of the police acting in ways that were counter to the sound cannon theory of how you break up protests. For example, the use of dogs. Now, some of this stuff was done by private security. Some of this stuff was done by the authorities on the ground. But when they spray protesters with water in sub-freezing temperatures, things like that, it's awful for the protesters. But it's something that people turn around and go, now, wait a minute, I don't know how I feel about that pipeline at all, but you shouldn't be spraying protesters with water in sub-freezing temperatures, right? In the civil rights protest of the 1960s, when you see dogs tearing up the, you know, arms and legs of black folks protesting because they can't use the same drinking fountains, I mean, it inflames public opinion because it arouses your sense of injustice. Now, I have to tell you something. I'm a pendulum kind of guy in a lot of ways. I strive for balance. I mean, that's what I kind of need to feel like justice is being done. When the pendulum swings too far in one direction, I sort of intrinsically in my soul want it to correct itself. In the realm of protest, it has swung too far onto the authority side of things. Sometimes authority needs to be reminded that we count and that you avoid dealing with us, meaning people on the ground, at your own peril, because we'll get your pipeline canceled. You know, I was reading somewhere where they were saying it's costing us a lot of money because this isn't happening right now. Well, guess what? Maybe a minority of people, who knows, but it was more than 80 Native American tribes signed on to support this thing, and some veterans were going to show up. That's when it was going to be game over, because all of a sudden, how do you portray that in a negative light, right? You've got veterans standing as a human shield. You want to spray them with cold water? I mean, what's so fun, I don't mean to use, it's maybe the wrong adjective, but for a person like me, when you look at something like that, you sit there and go, that was just a few people, basically, folks. The hardest thing in the world to imagine if you say we have to get out in the street and protest is to get what you think the right amount of people over the right amount of time is to be effective. You look at the 1960s and you're talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people week after week. And you can't imagine that. I'm sorry, I can't imagine us doing. I mean, things that would have to happen to have that happen, hard to imagine. But these protests weren't anywhere near that large. But you add the social media aspect, you add the other outside media too, the new media and places that are not the main, you know, corporate media. I mean, all of a sudden do you think I'm right about this? This is my theory, and I'm sure I'm like the last person to come up with it, so my apologies. But I mean, didn't social media and all that seem to have a real multiplier effect here? To take the numbers and magnify the situation so that it had the same amount of impact that when I was growing up, you would have had to have had a lot more people out there to have had the same amount of ability. I mean, the pipeline, even if this is a delay, is not happening now. And as one of the people in the article I read said, it's costing them a lot of money. So you got to call that some kind of a victory, right? So regardless of how you feel about the pipeline, remember something. You may want people protesting your viewpoints out there to have an impact down the road someday, too. So, as I said, the pendulum to me has swung too far in the anti-protest direction. I takes some enjoyment out of watching this victory. And congratulations to the people that put in the effort. Let's not forget how hard that is. Nonetheless, we'll see what happens on that deal. You know I'm a cynic. Now, on another issue, this is connected to protests, too. Somebody wrote me, yes, Ben, if he exists, filters through the emails, and sent me this one from someone who said, because I had said in a recent show, we were talking about how to handle the Trump presidency, and we were talking about when you get out in the streets and you protest things, and I said, well, when he does something. And this person wrote about Trump's recent comment on flag burnings and how he thought it should be illegal, or that maybe you should have your citizenship revoked. And he asked, is this when we should be protesting? And first, I want to put it in a little context here, because in the late 80s, we were already debating the same thing with the president. Presidents like to take this position sometimes because it's, what's a good way to put this? And it's especially true with Trump. You're going to get two things from the Trump presidency. You're going to get the flash, and then you're going to get the policy. The flash is for public consumption, and every president uses the flash. But this guy coming from his, you know, semi-reality TV background and the super tweeting and all this, he's known for making a splash. So for him, the flash may be one of his real strong points. The flash is when you come out and throw out something like a tweet about flag burning and everybody goes up in arms and people start talking about it and you position yourself in a certain place. Policy is much more the question of what you're going to get done. Now, if Trump actually had some control over the flag burning issue, right, if he could make a presidential decree saying if you burn a flag, you're not a citizen anymore, well, that might be a real reason to get scared, but let's remember the man's limitations in the role. There are some things he can do instantly on his own orders. There are a lot of things he needs help with. Now, if he circumnavigates the normal channels, well, then you have to go march because then, well, that's something crazy. For example, the Supreme Court has said that flag burning is a First Amendment right. So Trump can say anything he wants about it, but he can't do anything. So it's a wonderful maybe position. It's a little flash to throw out there. I'll get this position. Everyone will be talking about it. I'll gain some street cred with the super patriot crowd. I'll be able to say the flag means so much to me. I would make it illegal. Wink, wink. Nod, nod. But nothing gets done because, of course, the Supreme Court says you can't. If he goes around the Supreme Court somehow, then you have to go out and protest that, right, if you want to defend the idea that the president can't do that. It is interesting, Ben. Have you been reading those articles about President Obama and all these people now all of a sudden real worried about President Obama's pushing the envelope of military presidential powers, just like George W. Bush did before him, and now they're worried about handing it over to Trump? Gee, really? We just can't be more short-sighted, can we? We just can't. I mean, these are not problems where we should be blindsided. And one wonders whether anybody was, which makes it even weirder to think about them going, you know, someday these powers will be in the hands of somebody we really, you know, can't trust. I mean, you may trust Trump, but someday even more extreme people are going to get that job. What sort of powers do you want the most extreme of these people to have? So the minute the president starts steamrolling other branches of government openly and quickly, you got to get out and protest that, which is what makes you think that the flag burning thing is just another wink, nod, flash piece of marketing. Policy, as we said, though, is different. So let me go into an admittedly probably boring and certainly opinionated section. If you don't like this stuff, time to turn off the program now. But I thought we would go over, just to say that we're caught up with some of the people that Trump has tapped for various positions, cabinet appointments, secretaries, those kind of things. Some of these positions he has the right to just instantly say, this is the person I want, and boom, it's done. But a bunch of these people have to be confirmed by the Senate, you know, first. So not all this stuff is a done deal. If I had to say how it looks overall, I would say it's dominated by a bunch of people who look like they would have been the people appointed if people like Rick Santorum or Mike Huckabee had been the GOP nominee. For those of you in Europe, these are people who were getting, like, I think, single digits in terms of support, people that would never, ever, ever be elected by the general electorate because that was in the GOP, and those people weren't getting that kind of support from their own party. Imagine what the general electorate would have thought of them. But when you get some of these people Trump is putting in some of these important positions, I can't imagine a Rubio or a Bush or even a Christie putting those guys anywhere near these jobs. Now, you might say, that's why I voted for Trump, and I get it, but I'm not so sure that what we're seeing is anything like draining the swamp. I mean, take, for example, what I consider to be the worst person picked for a gig so far. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. That's a bad pick. I mean, if you think that's a good pick, we are very far from the same part of the political spectrum. I mean, let's just take one thing that's going to be very interesting. How about, and by the way, for those who don't know, this might save my argument. I was just about ready to concede that I was wrong about this, and Jeff Sessions may save me in this whole question about, you know, that there will or won't be some face-off between the federal government and the states that have legalized marijuana. I was just about to concede that because I said there was going to be, and it didn't look like it. And the money was starting to roll in. It was going into the hands of politicians, and you're starting to think, the dynamic is shifting. Could be wrong about this, Dan. And now Trump appoints one of the top people I can think of who would just salivate at the idea of a marijuana legalization rollback. He would like the challenge. He would enjoy the fight. If it's possible that that can happen, Trump just put a guy in one of the most important jobs in the country, Attorney General, who would do it. So to imagine him not doing it, you have to imagine Trump saying, and he might, that's not a priority of mine. I don't think it's bad if you smoke pot, so don't do that. And he could just simmer in muttering, grumbling silence in the corner of the room. But we'll see if that happens. He's not a big gay marriage, gay person friendly in terms of rights. And I mean, he just not his thing. Pretty anti that. Anti climate change in terms of belief, pro civil forfeiture, pro torture, pro Big Brother surveillance. I guess I'm trying to find the silver lining here and I'm not seeing it. Jeff Sessions is the best example you'll find of a pick that most of the people on the GOP stage that Trump was running against wouldn't have picked either, because it would have been somebody where they go, listen, I'm not going to get support even from members of my own party for this guy. And you might be saying, listen, Dan, that's what an outsider means. The party's not going to like that. I get that. And I also like the idea of outside-the-box people. But outside-the-box could mean outside-the-box good, and it could also mean outside-the-box bad. It just means everything outside-the-box. Jeff Sessions is outside-the-box bad, in my opinion. So far, the worst choice, in my opinion. Now, best choice? This may come off a little unconventional. It also makes me reminds me to be careful of the media portrayal sometimes of these people. But it's the Secretary of Defense choice, James Mattis, former General James Mattis. Now, disclaimer, I don't particularly love the Secretary of Defense coming from the military. Traditionally, it's a civilian position. George Marshall, the only military guy to get it, and it was a special deal. I think this would have to be a special deal, too. He's not allowed by law, I don't think, to be. He's not far enough away from active service, I think, to get the gig without a special waiver. Now, as I've said before, I spent some time with Mattis once, about 12 hours, 8 to 12 hours, in the company of about 10 or 12 other people, and we were also with Vice Admiral Harwood, and that was the CENTCOM meeting that I went to. And I have to say, Mattis was the guy who presided over it because he was the head of CENTCOM at the time. He was soon to be on his way out from President Obama, and I think he knew it at the time. But what I saw in that room is so different than the media portrayals of the guy that I think they may have him wrong. And that wouldn't surprise me. One of the things that the media always gets wrong with these generals is their sort of their public imaging, and they all have it, and they all have nicknames. And the nicknames are always these uber gung-ho kind of things that the media can then take and run with. Well, this is what they call him, therefore this is what he is. And in Mattis's case, he's Mad Dog Mattis. So they've had a lot of fun with that. His other one is closer to the truth, the warrior monk, because that's the impression. I mean, there were three things that when I was with him, I remember thinking initially. One is that he was extraordinarily well-read. And you know I like that in a person. And he was well-read on the classics, and I like that in a person even more. He had a sense of history and context, and he talked about it a lot. I like that also. Finally, and this came through over and over again, he had a sense of limitations. And that's refreshing. And it made me think something about Trump's decision to appoint this particular military guy to the job. We have to remember that Trump has some unique things that he's bringing to the table here, including some unique deficiencies. He may need different kinds of people than the traditional political operative that's been in Washington for years would need. Mattis is the kind of guy that might be able to tell Trump what Trump needs to hear on limitational questions. I mean, the famous interview where Trump was supposed to have asked why we can't use atomic bombs. Well, a guy like former General James Mattis would be able to explain that to him. And I'm pretty convinced he would. Now, understand something. The reason you don't always want military people in these kind of roles is because traditionally they are more gung-ho than civilians. Not always. Sometimes it can be the other way. But if you look at history from about the end of the Second World War on, the military are reliably, you know, the really gung-ho types. So you have to be careful if you have too many of them because you're going to get too many gung-ho opinions, right? The Joint Chiefs of Staff are going to give you gung-ho opinions usually. I think if you're going to have a general in the position, Mattis is going to tell you some limitations. He's going to be uber concerned, I think, about casualties and whatnot. He's going to be very cognizant of how do you get out. I think he mentioned that when I was with him multiple times. How do you get out? What's the exit strategy? I mean, if you do this, how do you win? Again, you would expect that from all your generals, but you don't always get it. I also think that Trump might have a little trouble interacting directly with his generals. I think maybe having Mattis there as some sort of buffer would be nice. So I think it's an interesting pick for an outsider president who may need different things than the normal people we get in the role. But then he also wants General Michael Flynn to be his national security advisor, and I don't like that pick anywhere near as much. And what's more, I'm not sure I can imagine very well Mattis working well with Flynn. Flynn's not a guy who makes a ton of friends in his profession. Now, once again, you can blame that on being an outsider, right? They tend to make some enemies, and the general group doesn't like him very much because they think differently, so you might make that case. But Flynn's one of those generals that gets uncomfortably close to blaming religion for the war on terror for me. As you know, if you listen to this program, I look at the war on terror as more of a social, cultural, and political problem than a military one or a religious one. And it's not because it's not a problem of religion, but it's not a problem you can solve by being against religion. You're only going to solve it working with. I mean, it's the old Apache Scouts thing. I mean, sometimes you need, in order to gain victory, the help of some of the other people in the group, the minority of which you're having a problem with. So I differ fundamentally on the idea, and I don't like a general in a position where he's advising a president who already kind of thinks that way right now, that maybe he should think more that way. And if you want to do that, here's how you might accomplish it. I don't like the pick. As a special advisor, a chief strategy guy, he's got the guy from Breitbart, Steve Bannon. And there's a lot of people in the press freaking out about this, but I wouldn't worry so much about this guy. This is something presidents do. You bring in your people that are going to keep you in touch with your base. And this guy is going to have his ear to the ground. He's, you know, one of the bigwigs was over at Breitbart, and they called themselves once upon a time like the website for the alt-right. I think some of the hardcore alt-right call them the alt-light. Nonetheless, it'll keep Trump's ear to the ground, and he'll know when to come out and deliver a little flash to the masses. By the way, I should also point out that historically speaking, when you get these big change administrations, I think back to the first Reagan administration, they come in with, I don't want to say the wild people, but the wildest people that they have in the history of their administration are the ones that they bring with them initially, because they always bring the outsider ideologues. I mean, Reagan brought in all these people that you know, the James Watts and the Alexander Haigs and all these people that eventually got weeded out, some of them pretty quickly. The Reagan second administration are much more of these hardliner corporate or military guys with, you know, a lot more experience, a lot more heavy duty insider types than he initially came in with. And Trump may do the same thing. Some of these people may work themselves out of a job. And heck, wasn't that Trump's line? You're fired. There might be a lot of that going on early on. Another pick I like is the Ben Carson pick.
maybe for all the wrong reasons. You remember Ben Carson, right? He was one of the guys who ran against Trump, the African-American neurosurgeon. Got a great story. Some of it is disputed, but, you know, what we know about it's great anyway. The stuff that's totally confirmable is great. And I look at Carson as a bit of an experiment here that I'd like to see how it goes, because I'm one of those people who advocates bringing in different sets of eyes to look at problems. And especially in government and bureaucracy, I think you can have the bubble tendency and the insider tendencies. I mean, I think bureaucratic problems are well understood and known the world over. So I'm one of these people that subscribes to the belief that sometimes bringing in a fresh pair of eyes is a good idea. And I think Carson is a fresh pair of eyes. He's also an intelligent person, no doubt. And he's intelligent from a different realm, the neurosurgeon medical side of things. Now, I find that very interesting, right? I'm not sure it's the skill that would be best suited to having some outside eyes look at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is the job he's getting. One would think you would want someone like that in a medical job, you know, Health and Human Services. And for a while, there was somebody talking about that. Now, that might have been too big of a job for Carson. I don't know. And he might not be the right guy for this job either. But I think I like the fresh eyes approach, and it's not one of those positions that's going to get you killed if you have someone in there who's not great at it. I like the attempt. Let's get him in there and see if it makes any difference, right? I think he's a decent guy. I mean, just coming from an African-American background, a low-income background, and the success story that he is might play very well into I don't want to say changing the culture, because that sounds so trite, but bringing a new sensibility maybe to the gig. And like I said, I like the experiment because I talk about the value of this all the time. More real world examples would be nice. I don't think if he fails, that means it doesn't work, but I'd be curious to see how this works. It's an interesting pick. I'm not against it. I think the CIA pick, the director of CIA pick, how do you pronounce the last name? Is it Pompeo or Pompeo? Occupational hazard of those of us who are readers is we don't get to hear the TV announcers pronounce the name properly. So sometimes we don't. My apologies to the nominee. Not my favorite. Once again, you know, anyone who's real gung-ho when it comes to pushing the CIA to its limits, I'm against. And then he's one of those guys, straight up. I mean, you can explain it simply. If you want to go as far as the CIA has gone in the past, I don't want you, and I don't think you're good for things, and I'm against it. So he's a hardliner when it comes to CIA activities, and I think even a lot of people in the CIA these days don't want to go as far as Donald Trump has promised to go. So we'll see how that shakes out. I don't know if I've talked much about the VP, Pence. But same thing. I mean, if you imagine Mike Pence running for office as a presidential candidate with no Donald Trump at all, and imagine what his poll numbers would be by himself, he's too extreme in a bunch of different positions to have ever been elected, to have ever been in the running to be elected. So to think of him a heartbeat away, or a I'm throwing in the towel because this is not a fun gig anymore away from the top job is strange. It is a little like, once again, imagining a Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, you know, win for the White House. I mean, imagine how different this American country would be for those two guys to win on a ticket together, the White House, in a straight up election against a Democratic opponent. It's not really imaginable. And yet we're getting some of the appointees as if they had. Kind of interesting, huh? So I don't like Pence. I do find this interesting that if this is draining the swamp, it's an interesting definition of the term. Now, in terms of some of the other positions out there, Betsy DeVos, is it DeVos or Davos? Same problem I always have. Betsy DeVos, Secretary of the Department of Education. Now, here's the thing with her. There's a couple of people in Trump's administration that you almost want to damn for who they're affiliated with. Damn them for who they're married to or whatnot. Which I don't feel comfortable doing, but I'm not a big fan of her brother. He's the Blackwater guy, Eric Prince. But her background is interesting, and I think a lot of you are going to disagree with me about this. She's a big charter school person, it seems like, a big voucher proponent, a big school choice proponent. And my attitude on education is just not mainstream. But I have to tell you, I think it's a disaster.
I think it's a system created for a different America 100 years ago, and I think everyone's locked into it, the teachers, everybody. I mean, we're just stuck because it's so hard, just like reforming any other giant bureaucracy, to imagine wiping the slate clean and thinking about this differently with a 21st century eye to it. Think of all, I mean, think of the dominoes that would tumble, the people that would be hurt, the disruption it would cause. But if you could transform our results, think about what you would make possible. So I'm a bit of a gambler when it comes to this, and it makes it easier to gamble when things are in the state they are, right? The worse off they are, the more you're willing to gamble. And I do know that there are those of you out there who assert that this was part of the plan all along. Starve the schools, make them so bad that you offer ways out with school choice, and then you destroy the public school system. Well, I have to tell you something, folks. My need in this country is results-oriented. I want the best school system we can get that will educate all Americans. Boom. I'm willing to listen to all proposals for how we get there, and all I have to measure the theoretical potential of a proposal by is the real reality that Americans are dealing with right now. I can't get all conspiratorial and say it's because the Republicans wanted it this way. I just have to look at the fact that we're getting generations of kids now that aren't getting enough education. And before we get into the not spending enough money part again, look at the per student spending. We spend more than everybody. That's hard to get around. So Betsy DeVos seems to be somebody who's thinking outside the box on this, or maybe inside a different box because school choice has been around for a while. But I think if people with money can choose schools because they've got money, I think it's only fair that you would tell people in communities where their schools are failing that you are not confined to staying here. I just don't think that's right. Now, the thing that we use in this country, though, is the tool to do that, I think, is a shell game. It's BS. And this gets me to the next person in a second, but the idea of tax credits as a tool of government drives me nuts because of the way it's used and how certain the people that take advantage of tax credits are usually the ones who don't need them. And oftentimes when it comes for school vouchers, that's a tax credit type thing. I dislike that, but at least I know that that's a much more direct use of the tax credit because you can apply it directly right to the school sometimes. But like you take Tom Price, who's Trump's pick for the Secretary of the Health and Human Services Department. Now, Price was an orthopedic surgeon, so he comes from a medical background. He wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, what's new, everybody on his side kind of does. And listen, there's a lot of Americans who are really upset with what's happened to their insurance that would like to see it go, and there's a lot of Americans who couldn't get insurance before that are thankful and maybe alive today because they did. So I don't think that's going to turn out to be this thing that you can tar and feather him with too much, because a lot of people are going to go, good, because I want something better. But I'm not sure you're going to get something better with Tom Price. He's talking about tax credits, too, to buy insurance, and we've been down that road before. That's not something that's going to work. The problem with getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, and I get it, is that we're going to be in the same position that we were in before we had it, which, if you recall, was a bit of a crisis. In fact, when asked how we're going to get something to replace the Affordable Care Act once Republicans get rid of it, one of the guys said, and it's famous, it went all over the news wires everywhere, he said, we're going to do it because we're going to be facing a cliff. And, you know, that's when we actually act, paraphrasing there. But basically he was saying, hey, this will be the pressure to do something on this will be huge because, you know, look at how it gets. We remember how it gets. It got so bad. This country was talking about socializing medicine quite a bit more, and it was popular for a while. So people were ready for something to fix a problem that big. I think what, you know, some in the government are saying is that we have to create the problem exactly that big again to get the kind of movement from us in the legislature to create something better. We shall see. But tax credits for insurance ain't it. Trust me. Starting to sound like Trump, right? Trust me. There are some picks that I look at and just go, okay, nice to have some diversity. He's a tapped Governor Nikki Haley from South Carolina for U.S. ambassador to the U.N. That's one of those jobs, again, if you're competent, you'll do fine. I mean, there are certainly going to be better and worse people at it, but it's not a bad deal no matter what. It's nice to have Nikki Haley in there. And she's a perfect example of something I didn't expect to see too much of. I think of Trump as kind of a vindictive guy in terms of remembering old slights, but she kind of took after him during the campaign and wasn't all that nice. And so to get a position like this, The man can obviously forgive and forget in some cases. Elaine Chao for Secretary of Transportation. She's one of those people that has the experience. I mean, when you look at her resume, she certainly looks like she should be able to do the job. She's married to Mitch McConnell. For those who don't know outside the country, when Trump talks about draining the swamp, it's Mitch McConnell's swamp, just so you know. I mean, that's how close she is to the problem, in my opinion. I don't know how much you damn her for who she's married to. That's maybe not fair. At the same time, that's dang close to the center of the swamp for me, if you're talking about bringing in. And Mitch McConnell's the worst of the worst in terms of somebody who's just overstayed his welcome too long. There's like 20 of them that just need to go on the Republican side and 20 of them that need to go on the Democratic side. I mean, I was reading a story on how old the Democratic leadership is the other day. That is, they're all like in their mid-70s to late 70s. It's just geriatric. And you turn around and the whole story talked about how much talent the Democratic Party is losing from the middle-aged members of it because they're tired of waiting around. It's like Prince Charles in Great Britain. They're tired of waiting around for leadership positions to open because these 75 and 78-year-old people like Nancy Pelosi won't go anywhere. Do they use email, Ben? I mean, how out of touch are there some of these people? I remember meeting one, Mark Hatfield, once, and it was admittedly near the end of his career, but he might have been an automatron for all I knew. I mean, he had like a 22-year-old girl leading him around, telling him what he was going to do every 2 seconds, and he was like on autopilot when I met him. I think I like 45, 50, and 55-year-old legislators better. Not that I want to have some discriminatory rule, you understand, but right now the place is dominated by old people. I mean, when you're eating dinner at 4 o'clock in the Senate, cafeteria and it's crowded, that might be a bad sign. The Secretary of the Treasury, is it Steve Mnuchin? Steve Mnuchin? I'm going to go with that. I do not know this guy well. I looked up his resume. And, you know, it's Secretary of Treasury. It's what you'd expect. The guy was a hedge fund manager. He's a Goldman Sachs guy. And, you know, initially your first thought is, oh, yeah, that's exactly who we need, right? Bring in one of those guys again. Crash the economy all over. Insider, crony capitalism, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I do wonder how realistic it is to have a Secretary of the Treasury who hasn't been involved in all that stuff before. And I honestly don't know. I don't know if you could reasonably be expected to do that job if you had no background, you know, as a hedge fund manager or a Wall Street guy. Or do you know what I'm saying? I mean, some positions you can imagine people doing, and then there's others where you go, I'm not sure it's a, I mean, who else would you get? And as I said, there may be some logical choices that are escaping me right now for Treasury Secretary and not having any background. I mean, maybe you could make a case that so much of that industry was tainted by the recent financial crisis that there's no place safe. You can't say, oh, he was with that really bad firm. Well, no, because like all the firms you can think of got a reputation for not such great stuff back then. So there's really no safe haven, although I will admit that Goldman Sachs is maybe in a place all its own. Nonetheless, I don't know enough about the guy, and I'm not sure what the proper resume thing should be, if not something from the world of finance. So perhaps once again, one could make a case that if Trump were trying to do something different, you would want to have somebody from, an insider like the corporate lawyer guy he's got as his White House counsel. Maybe you make the case that I need an insider to know, you know, what loopholes to close, for example. Of course, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who might have been an answer to who you might put in charge of the Secretary of the Treasury job, depending on your administration. She called him the Forrest Gump of the financial crisis. And she was quoted in a Business Insider article as saying about him, quote, his selection as Treasury Secretary should send shivers down the spine of every American who got hit hard by the financial crisis and is the latest sign that Donald Trump has no intention of draining the swamp and every intention of running Washington to benefit himself and his rich buddies, end quote. Well, allowing for the partisan hyperbole that you can expect in something like that, she knows him better than I do, and so we will be watching carefully on the Treasury front. Now, I do think you're seeing some early things from Trump that fall more into the flash category. Remember, policy is different and appointments are different than things like, for example, Trump throwing out a line about a 35% tariff on companies that, you know, leave America, or going to that one company and basically getting them to decide to stay in the U.S. with a sort of a singular deal. As one person I was reading, one of the columnists said, you can't do that with every single company, right? It's almost like you bought yourself a photo opportunity with one deal for one place. And who knows what it is? I don't know that it's been made public, but just sort of negotiating it on a single company by single company basis, that's a flash thing. That's a photo op that he's created. He's going to have to come up with some plan that really, I mean, it's going to be really difficult to try to figure out. And you're going to have to think outside. You're going to have to get all James Goldsmith on this problem and try to figure out, in a world that's already gone far down the path of, say, you know, taking wages down to the lowest levels possible, how you can turn things around from that point. And can you do it without it being massively destabilizing? And the problem we have sometimes is that the tools that seem the most obvious to deal with these kind of problems are ones we used to use a long time ago. A 35% tariff is a perfect example. There might have to be a different way to do this. But that requires some real heavyweight thinkers on questions of economics and globalization and whatnot. I don't see any on the list right now for Trump, but in all fairness to him, there's a lot of the advisors still to be filled out. And maybe that interesting outside-the-box thinker on globalization is right around the corner. We shall keep an open mind. We've been telling you about Audible for a long time on this program, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, audiobooks, and a whole lot more, every category you can think of. If you think about your standard bookstore and what it has in it, well, Audible's got that, and then stuff maybe you didn't even consider. Old magazine articles, for example, just as good when you get them on Audible, but you won't find them in your traditional bookstore. And I've watched as the industry that Audible is sort of at the center of has evolved over time. And I have a special interest in this, by the way, not just because Audible's been a supporter for so long, but because as a podcaster, I'm watching my own industry evolve and grow and change and define itself and find its niche. And there are some things that podcasting does that are better than anyone else for certain kinds of things. And every media is like that, right? Audiobooks are no different. When I try to think of a good book to recommend, when we're talking about Audible in the program, for example, I'll try to find books that translate best to that medium. So, for example, I might want to tell you, and I may have told you, about books like Adam Tooze's approach to the Second World War or the period between the two world wars. And he has a kind of an economic history approach, but his books are filled with tables and graphs and figures and stuff that doesn't really translate as well to an audiobook. That's a textbook. That's what books that are done in text do so well. That's their niche. But I have a recommendation on Audible for you today that is an example of what audiobooks do better than anyone else in terms of the kind of stories that they can tell that's just superior to any other kind of way to consume it. And it's part of that art form growing and finding its place, its unique place. There's a book called Taking Charge, and I don't know if we've told you about this before a long time ago or not. It's a book about the Lyndon Johnson presidency, Taking Charge, the Johnson White House Tapes, 1963-1964. The author's name is Michael R. Beschloss. I hope I pronounced the name correctly. But if you were to read this book as a textbook, the way when I was growing up, you know, you consume books exclusively, there would be so much that you would lose that come out in the glorious color of an audiobook. Namely, Lyndon Johnson's voice itself. I mean, this is a book that can incorporate Lyndon Johnson's secret White House tapes, which is the subtitle of the program, right, of the book. You can read a transcript of it, or you can hear it. And then you can hear the author tell you what it means and give you some context, and then give you another sample from the actual tape. So as you watch audiobooks evolve, it's quickly changing from an either or sort of thing. You either like textbooks or you like audiobooks, to something where you simply match it towards your need and the medium that tells the story the best. Sometimes that'll be television, sometimes radio, sometimes podcasting, sometimes textbooks, and sometimes audiobooks. And Taking Charge, the Johnson White House tapes, that's an audiobook if I've ever heard one. And if you'd like a free audiobook, you can get one with a 30-day trial membership sign up at Audible. And you can get that by going to audible.com/Dan Carlin. audible.com/Dan Carlin.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.
Want to help the podcast? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com. It doesn't cost you a penny more, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.